1984 is now. Written by George Orwell. Narrated by Jeffrey Giuliano and the Ark. Part 1. The timeless literary masterpieces we offer you must be well acted, voiced, and narrated. Created with the hope of engendering a powerful, positive, inspirational response. You know there remains a special place in the hearts of all for these beautifully crafted, timeless combinations of inspirational words and emotion. We know as the classics. Tales so beautifully wrought, they conjure up deep feelings of reverence and inspiration for the listener. This, too, is a classic. A thundering calliope of raindropped words pounding against our consciousness, compelling us to be new and better people. That can only be achieved by a classic. A bubbling up of untamed desire and raw feeling from the depths of our being. That, too, must be the function of classic literature. To reshape the heart, mind, and spirit of all, moving us on to greater heights of understanding, is also well within the power of the classics. Here we first imagine, then create, and finally pass on the very best of the literary realm from both then and now. This is our only mandate. So we welcome you, one and all, young and old, schooled and enterprising, to the wonderful world of literature's greatest triumphs and word portraits from the ever-changing, always engaging human spirit. This is classic literature.
Blue skies from now on.
This is our land, a land of peace and of plenty, a land of harmony and hope. This is our land, Oceania. These are our people, the workers, the strivers, the builders. These are our people, the builders of our world, struggling, fighting, bleeding, dying. On the streets of our cities and on the far-flung battlefield, fighting against the mutilation of our hopes and dreams. Who are they? Eurasia. They are the dark enemies. The dark, murdering enemies of Eurasia. In the barren deserts of Africa and India. On the oceans of Australia. Courage, strength, and youth are sacrificed. Sacrificed to barbarians. Even as we grasp at victory, there is a cancer, an evil tumor, growing, spreading in our midst. Shout, shout, shout out his name, Goldstein. Nothing, the party says, is true. Nothing the party does is good. Even the war itself isn't real. The party wants you to believe that we are at war, so as to channel your aggressions away from their rightful target, the party. Big Brother is not real. He is pure fiction created by the party. The real rulers of the state are unknown, faceless manipulators who, because they are not known, are able to wield without let or hindrance. People of Oceania, you are being duped. We are not at war with Eurasia. Death! Death, traitor! You are being made into obedient, stupid slaves of the party. Open your eyes. See the evil that is happening to you. The party drops bombs on its own citizens. Traitor! It is the party, not the Eurasians, who are our enemies. Rise up. Throw off the yoke. You have nothing to lose and everything to gain.
The principal thing started in his place in the home. He was lonely. If he'd had a brother, he'd have been much happier. And then there wasn't a great deal of harmony in his family, between his parents, and he grieved over that.
Mr. Blair wasn't with his family in the early years. He was still out in India when the family came back to England. But Eric, I think, had hardly seen his father at all. until he was about 8 or so.
He was a very reserved kind of man.
A very, very reserved sort of man. And rather the sort of children should be seen and not heard and keep off the flower beds kind of a man.
His father was very disappointed and looked upon him as a sort of failure. And he felt that deeply. But his mother and I were very good friends. And she said to me, you know, Eric loves his father far more than he loves me. And I said, no, I don't think he does. It is that he wants his father to acknowledge him as a successful son. A son who couldn't make money in old Mr. Blair's concept was not the right sort of
so
son.
So what was this little boy, Eric Blair, like? What impression did he make on you when you first saw him here? Well, this is how I described him, writing about it a few years afterwards. Tall, pale, with his flaccid cheeks, large spatulate fingers and supercilious voice, he was one of those boys who seem born old. We often walked together over the downs in our green jerseys and corduroy breeches discussing literature, and we both won in consecutive years the inevitable Harrow History Prize. I was a stage rebel, or well, a true one.
Was he liked, or was he reasonably popular?
Well, yes, you know, there was always something about him that people couldn't help liking him. However much he shocked them and disapproved of them and antagonized them, in nearly all cases, something shone through about him which made you want him to like you a little bit better. And you never lost your temper with him, although he was absolutely maddening.
They'd get together, the whole school, outside the gymnasium, and bay and boo at them.
Why were they hated? Because they were cleverer, or...?
Yes, I think partly jealousy, and partly... Well, they were different.
Was it an abnormally snobbish school, do you think?
Well, I think England was an abnormally snobbish country. I think the school simply reflected the pre-1914 feeling that if you weren't what was called in society, you were no one. If you weren't connected with large houses and the establishment kind of jobs, you were no one, and it was your business to get yourself made into someone as fast as possible.
Cyril, what did you talk to George about on these walks on the Downs?
Well, I think a lot of the time we talked about the books we'd been reading, and then there was our secret reading, which we enjoyed very much. We could talk about to each other. Of course, he liked these very morbid stories about mysterious plagues and illnesses. He liked the Mask of the Red Death, and he liked all Wells's imaginative stories about people from other worlds causing epidemics and pestilences. And he liked these fearful, morbid moral questions like, would you drink a pint of blood to save your father?
He gave me that crucifix when he gave me Dracula. It's got the Virgin and Child on one side and the Christ on the crucifix on the other. And he gave me that, and he also gave me a clove of garlic. Mm. The clove of garlic has departed many years ago, but anyway, that's what he gave me in order to protect me from Dracula.
The following verses were composed and written by Master Eric Blair, the 11-year-old son of Mr. R.W. Blair of Roselawn, Shipley.
Oh, give me the strength of the lion, the wisdom of Reynard the fox, and then I'll hurl troops at the Germans and give them the hardest of knocks. Oh, think of the warlord's mailed fist that is striking at England today, and think of the lives that our soldiers are fearlessly throwing away. Awake, oh, you young men of England, for if, when your country's in need, you do not enlist by the thousand, you truly are cowards indeed.
How about your writing aspirations? We did start, both of us, to write poetry, and we did show it to each other. And I've got a letter. I think it must be the first known Orwell manuscript that there is, which is his criticism of a piece of poetry of mine.
What was the subject of your poem?
The Death of Lord Kitchener.
Good God.
So that takes you back to 1916. But this is what I luckily found this letter to my mother. And this is how I describe him in the letter. terribly interesting. I enclose a poem I made up about Lord Kitchener a few nights ago. I know it's pretty putrid stuff, but you won't mind so much as I made it up. Well, now here we come to the end of the poem where I write, "Stern criticism, please." And then this is written in Orwell's very, very adult handwriting, quite different from most schoolboys.
It is indeed, yes.
Dashed good. Slight repetition. Scansion excellent. Meaning a little ambiguous in places. Epithets for the most part well selected. The whole thing is neat, elegant and polished. E. A. Blair.
Wonderful. I like it very much.
What, Blair? No, rather the reverse. Dull, uninteresting, unattractive. That won't do for everyone is his fan now, but of course I only knew him as a kid. He probably became brilliant after Eton. Did he go to Oxford? No. Blair, who had a plain circular moon face and fair greasy hair, used to put extra grease on his hair so that when she pulled it, as a punishment for his not having done his prep, her hand slipped off.
George Orwell was born on June 25th, 1903. He was an English novelist, essayist, journalist, and critic. His work is characterized by lucid prose, biting social criticism, and outspoken support of democratic socialism. As a writer, Orwell produced literary criticism and poetry, fiction and journalism. He is known for his allegorical novella Animal Farm of 1945 and the dystopian novel 1984, which he wrote in 1949. His non-fiction works, including The Road to Wigan Pier of 1937, documented his experience of working-class life in the north of England, and Homage to Catalonia of 1938, an account of his experiences soldiering for the Republican faction of the Spanish Civil War, which took place from 1936 to 1939. All of these works are critically respected, as are his essays on politics and literature, language and culture. In 2008, The Times ranked George Orwell second amongst the 50 greatest British writers since 1945. Orwell's work remains influential in popular and political culture, and the adjective Orwellian, describing authoritarian social practice, is now part of the English language, like many of his sayings, such as Big Brother, Thought Police, 2 Minutes Hate, Room 101, Memory Hole, Newspeak, Doublethink, Proles, Unperson, and Thought Crime, as well as providing direct inspiration for groupthink.
I remember him very well, but really sort of more to look at. And I mean, he used to be in places, but he was very shy, and quiet, and, you know, did sort of become jolly with us all. I think he was thinking of thoughts.
He didn't join in parties, did he?
No.
He had individual friends.
Yes. Yes, he was like that.
He used to walk along the River Orwell, especially, which he loved. That's why he took the name Orwell.
And the marshes, he loved. He loved everything to do with that kind of thing. And he was always awfully nice, you know, very nice manners, and very quiet, gentle. But, of course, he never looked like an Eton scholar, did he?
No, he looked rather like a tramp always.
Yes.
But he was just that little bit above ordinary people, yes. Like myself.
And myself.
Was he striking looking?
Very tall and lanky. He had an awfully nice face, you know.
But well, nothing, yes, a gentle, kind face.
Not good looking at all.
And you remember that his sleeves were always up there, didn't you?
Yes, he'd very, grown very out of his bony. Sleeves. wrists, and yes, as though he'd grown out of his clothes, but he couldn't have looked like that at Eton.
No, he had to conform there.
I suppose he was having holidays.
What was the family like? Did they join in much in the life of the town?
Yes, in a quiet way, but Mrs. did.
Yes, Mrs. Blair was a bridge player, and we had a club then which she used to run. And
the father was very natty and tidy, and
yes, with a buttonhole.
Always with a buttonhole.
I get the impression he was quite an awkward man. Some people have given me the impression he wasn't very forthcoming, quite reserved.
Old Mr. Blair.
Old Mr. Blair.
Well, he maybe that didn't come our way, or did he?
No, but I remember Dennis, my brother, saying that when he went to the club, he just sat there looking out, didn't join in the conversation. He told me that the other day. He just sat there sort of looking into space.
Yes.
Nice looking old man.
What did you like about him? What drew you?
He was... very good company. He was rather mature for about that age. He wasn't, what shall I say, wasn't light-hearted company. His humour was always rather satirical. But it was, boys loved that. And one found it rather grown up and very splendid. And he was also very well read, even that age. He certainly had an interest in words, in language, in the English. And I remember, for instance, we had, curiously enough, as our French master for a brief period, Aldous Huxley. And very incompetent he was, but we rather loved it because of his talk, the words he used. And we would try and remember. And Eric Blair certainly was very much interested in that sort of side.
He was less unhappy at Eton, but he always felt it wasn't a school for him. There were so many regulations. And there were things there that he felt. For instance, Huxley was a master there and was almost blind. And the boys used to tease him. Well, that worried Orwell a lot. He thought, how can anyone tease a blind man? That was just typical. See, many boys, I don't suppose, would have noticed it, would they? But he noticed it and he felt it.
He did have this great moral courage. I mean, no one could bully Orwell. He wasn't an athlete, but people respected him. They were a little bit frightened by him, and he wasn't beaten very much. Occasionally he was, but on the whole, people let him alone. At Eton, there was no bullying from top to bottom, but in the same year group, there would be bullies. And I remember once, after prayers, walking down the corridor in college, past the various people's rooms, and as I went by, rather like a terrible gangster film, a hand reached out and yanked me into this room, and there were the bullies, two of them, just like two killers from Chicago, and they said, "Connolly, what the hell do you mean by talking so much to boys in the election above? You're sucking up to them, and you know, you spend all your time bleating poetry to Rylands." And so they then proceeded to start punishing me, you know, hitting me from one to the other. And I'd been with Orwell. He was walking just behind me. And he saw me disappear. And instead of walking on, as many sort of politic little boys would have done, he came in there. He opened the door. And when he came in, he saw the bigger of these two bullies. And he simply just went for him. He gave him one sort of terrific punch. And then yanked me out again, and then we resumed our walk down the corridor, still talking about
That's very nice.
Samuel Butler.
He wasn't terribly interested in the academic side of school life. And in a way, I felt certainly the later years, he was longing for the moment when he could get away from it. He wasn't jealous of me going to Cambridge. I don't think he wanted to go to a university. I think it's the idea that he was thwarted from going to university, I think, is quite wrong. He always talked about going back to the East.
Did he really?
Oh, yes, he was absolutely fascinated by that. He had very early memories of it, which I think were glamorized. And that's why I think the disillusion of the East was so great.